What's up and welcome to this episode of You Seem Interesting. I'm your host, Danny Rouillet. Thanks as always for checking us out. It is an honor to be this little tiny bite of information on your cell phone, on your tablet, or on your computational device until that very moment when you say, yep, right now, I'll play the musings of this pudgy idiot that doesn't have all that much to say. Very cool. Listen to us for free. That's awesome. Amazon Music, Google Pods, Spotify, Apple Music, the whole nine yards. You're a paying customer. You're the best. You get us first. You get us early. And you are the premiums. So patreon.com/funnydanny for that. My guest this week is a certified badass. Mark Polymeropoulos is his guest. He's part of the Difficult Last Name Club, along with your friendly neighborhood podcast host. Mark spent nearly three decades working for the CIA, was stationed all over the world in some of the most challenging, difficult places, has a wealth of experience. He's now an author, he's retired, and is kind of moving into the next phase of his life as a speaker and as somebody that's got some amazing stories to tell and some lessons learned from a lifetime spent in the field doing things that are pretty much hard to fathom for you and me with our commutes and our kind of more basic stuff. He was tasked with just some incredibly difficult difficult to manage, just unbelievable challenges, and we'll get some great stories out of him here in a few moments. Kind enough to join me for a few minutes. But before we get into the nitty-gritty about the CIA and interview with Mark, it's time for what we always do, Strangest Gimmick in All the Podcasts.
It is once again time for the Strangest Gimmick in All of Podcasting, a moderately passable celebrity impression asking you for money.
Please come to me with a favor. I must tell you, this is something I cannot do. When is the last time you had me over to your house for coffee? I went to my Patreon page, patreon.com/funnydanny. So on this day, I cannot grant you this favor.
I don't know. I don't know if that's my best one. It's not even, it's probably bottom tier, to be honest with you. A little Godfather action for you. Anybody under 35, it's a pretty good movie. You should check it out. So let's get into some of the nitty and the gritty about the CIA, the Central Intelligence Agency. 1947 is the year of the founding, and kind of the predecessor agencies spawned out of World War II before the CIA existed. It was kind of a combination of the U.S. military, the FBI, and various parts of the government that were tasked with intelligence gathering. As the world started to get more complicated geopolitically, it became pretty obvious. It came intuitive. Hey, we've got to have something that's purely dedicated to intelligence gathering and information. And this is not a policymaking apparatus. Even though the CIA is underneath the executive branch, they're not sitting here telling you, here's our new doctrine. Here's what we're going to do and how we're going to enforce it. That's not what they do. What they do is provide the information, and they give the options, kick it up the ladder, whether it ultimately gets into the ear of the president, national security advisors, and the like. There was a restructuring that took place in 2004 under George Bush, which we'll get to in a second. But you're basically thinking about stopping threats before they start. That's what the CIA does. So we know historically, some of our, you know, the things that you learned about in history class, the moments where it didn't go as planned. And I'll get to a couple of those here in a second. But there are tens of thousands of victories that we never hear about. And that means it worked, right? That means the plan worked, the machine worked. And we'll talk to Mark about that here in a second. But it's about collecting foreign intelligence, producing objective analysis, not colored with opinion, right? This is, hey, this is this level of threat for the sake of argument. 1 to 100, we think this is a 57. You want to act on it? That's your call, but this is what we're giving to you. Conduct covert action, again, as directed by the president. So what does that look like? That's basically, and Mark will go into this here in a little bit when we bring him on, that's everything from surveillance, that's asset building, that's getting folks that may have a grievance against their home nation or government or army or otherwise, people that, you know, you're turning assets. And that takes an awful lot of expertise, craftsmanship, identifying prospects where that might work out. So in terms of, again, the CIA's mission and kind of what they do, this is not a law enforcement arm. And I think a lot of people sometimes just sort of feel like the CIA is kind of all things. It is really and truly about intelligence and passing on that information to those that would act, be they military, be they law enforcement, or otherwise. It's about, again, stopping things before they start. So from the CIA's own website, they lead specialized multidisciplinary mission centers to address high priority issues, including nonproliferation. Again, that's weapons changing hands that could do a lot of damage, counterterrorism, counterintelligence, organized crime, narcotics trafficking, and arms control, just to name a few. This is heavy hitter stuff. This isn't, you know, somebody sneaking a couple pounds of pot over the border. This is major game changing type stuff. You know, sort of the destabilization of a lot of different enterprises that could do an awful lot of harm to U.S. citizens and really, you know, just sort of folks in our interests around the world. And as you look at the CIA now, it went from this fledgling agency that was sort of, you know, again, started right in the aftermath of World War II to once it was sort of fully, I guess, established by President Truman, it's gone, from this small sort of fledgling agency to right now they're probably around 22,000 or so employees, countless assets around the world, everything from informants to, you know, to folks that have, you know, really put themselves at great personal risk. And it's hard to talk about that, honestly, without talking about what's going on here in Afghanistan with a lot of our allies that helped our military and a lot of folks on the ground, including Mark, who was stationed in Afghanistan, by the way, for some time, you know, counteract what was going on with the Taliban and a lot of the other terrorist groups sort of in that region. But and let's go real quick again before I bring Mark on. I mentioned this, and I'm not doing this to say to pick on the CIA, but you kind of only hear about it when it goes wrong. And the most infamous time, I would say, when that happened would probably be the Gary Powers U-2 spy plane that was shot down over Russia. That led to sort of some icy relations between the United States and Khrushchev there in Russia. And that was one of those things that was the preamble to then the Bay of Pigs invasion, Cuban Missile Crisis, and a whole lot of escalation in intensity between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. The two superpowers really escalated the Cold War right there. Because, I mean, listen, the CIA's mission there, in that case, they've got to get the intel. They've got to figure out what's Russia doing, how are they doing it, and what's their intent. Because they knew the capability was there. Whether they've got, let's say for the sake of argument, 100 missiles or 77, there's a lot of destruction happening. But what are they planning on doing? And this is something that's very near and dear to my heart, by the way, just as a quick personal side. My grandfather spent the majority of his professional career in the intelligence community as well. He worked for the fledgling NSA for years and was kindly asked to maybe change assignments after he wrote a very left-wing manifesto under the pseudonym. And he wasn't that clever. He used the pseudonym of his uncle. So that wasn't necessarily the best way to fool an intelligence agency. But then he spent the overwhelming majority of his career at the Center for Naval Intelligence, basically on the Russia desk, trying to figure out what they were doing and why they were doing it. So I've always kind of had this admiration and you know, some reverence here for the folks in the intelligence community. And Mark is a superstar. There's a lot of projects that he's engaged in. He just finished his book. It's been released. We'll give you all those details. We got them in the description, and I'll get them after the interview with Mark. But he is a star. You're going to love my conversation. So enjoy it with Mark Polymeropoulos. Excited about my guest this week. He and I have had very different careers, I would say, but we're both part of a very elite fraternity, Mark. We're part of this difficult-to-pronounce last-name fraternity. My guest is Mark Polymeropoulos. I worked on it, my pronunciation guide. I did YouTube videos. How did I do, my friend?
You did fantastic. And I love, you know, when I kind of start out talking to folks, I tell a story when I was in the Middle East a long time ago. I think it was 2005, 2006, I got a call. I was overseas, and I got a call from the president's briefers, and they were going down to see George W. Bush, and they wanted my take on a certain crisis situation. And you know, they went down, and I was excited. I was like, okay, the president's going to, you know, hear what I have to say. And I was waiting, and when they finally got back and they called, I said, how'd the Oval, you know, meeting in the Oval Office go? And they were like, well, George W. spent the whole time trying to pronounce your last name. And so I was like, but what do you think I had to say? What I had to say? They're like, well, no, really. He's like, really? He was trying to pronounce your last name. That's what we did the whole time. So you did very well. You're one up on W.
I could picture it. Mark Polyurethane. Mark Polyamor. Poly.
Nobody forgets you. You know, I grew up. Yeah. I played ice hockey growing up. Yeah. And my jersey had, you know, the letters of my last name was kind of like, you know, in a U, an inverted U, because sure, it couldn't fit across right across the top.
It is I've been there, done that, man. Tough hand in Scrabble. But let's get to your career. Just amazing. First of all, thank you for your service. Nearly 30 years in intelligence. You've just released a book. Congrats on that. But I want to go through a few different things with you here. I don't think people properly have an appreciation for intelligence officers like yourself for so many years that are stationed in places that we can't really comprehend and fathom. And I want to get to your Afghanistan experience specifically, but sure. You're in the Middle East and all over the world. Just kind of, I'd love for you to reflect on that, just sort of daily life in a place that's very different than our sort of very casual, comfortable, suburban, cul-de-sac, strip right. mall type existence.
What a fantastic question. And I'll give you just a quick snippet on this. So when we came back from an overseas posting, my son, who is playing baseball in college now, but he was a Little League baseball player, and he said, "Dad, why is the grass green on the field?" He was used to dirt fields all over the Middle East. So that's a perfect encapsulation of how things are different. But ultimately, I did seven what we call, operational tours, primarily in the Middle East, but I lived all over, certainly all over the world. But what it did for me, a couple of things. I mean, first of all, it was an incredible experience because you see different cultures and CIA officers, you have to have that willingness to be open-minded and you know, deal with foreigners, deal with people different. They speak funny languages, eat funny food, and you got to be into that. But what it really did for me is gave me appreciation for the United States and kind of the freedoms. And even though the U.S. has been going through some tough times, I still believe in that idea of a shining city on the hill. And so it gave me and my family really a tremendous appreciation of what we have in the U.S. Because, I lived in the third world. And so I saw extreme poverty and terrible repression and autocratic regimes. That's one of the things coming back here, now obviously being retired. I have a great appreciation. I live in Northern Virginia. I love this area. And so, I think that's something special that perhaps many people don't really understand who haven't kind of had those experiences and living in some kind of really tough places.
I have a good friend who is a State Department employee, and he lived all over the world and he shared that exact same sentiment with me. So it's interesting. I was going to actually ask you about it, but you covered it. One of the things in your materials that I just adore, just because you and I have a shared love for the game, baseball and the CIA. Why are there correlations? That's right. Why does it make sense to you in that way?
Because you deal with failure all the time. I mean, when I wrote my book, Clarity in Crisis, I think some people expected this to be kind of a chest thumping book. Like, I'm a Navy SEAL kind of charging up a hill, but actually it's not that. It's about dealing with failure and failing and dealing with failure and then how to overcome adversity. And there's nothing more, tougher than baseball in terms of, as a sport, you hit 300, that means you fail 7 out of 10 times. I mean, I think baseball players are the most mentally tough athletes on the planet because you deal with failure constantly. And so I think there's this huge similarity because in my job as an intelligence officer, and specifically in operations, is my job was to spot, assess, develop, and recruit, agents, spies. So I'm trying to find, a Russian presidential official or a Chinese military officer or an Iranian nuclear scientist who's going to spy for the United States. That's hard. And you're going to fail a lot in trying to get another individual to kind of commit treason and spy for the United States. So it's like hitting a curveball. Like, it's tough and you're going to fail a lot. So I think there's incredible similarities. I mean, I actually have gone on two separate occasions and given that talk about baseball and the CIA to groups of college and high school baseball coaches because they just get it. And so it's a process of how you deal with failure, and how you kind of learn from adversity. And I think, once you kind of accept that this is the way your profession is going to be, whether it's a baseball player or as a intelligence officer, you actually can succeed. And so I just think the similarities are incredible. I love talking about it. And of course, baseball is my favorite sport, and I'm really passionate about it.
So, Mark, go through that selection process. In other words, if you feel like you've identified a target, I imagine it's roughly equivalent to, an NFL front office talking about a draft pick, right? Where they're talking about pros and cons and upside and access and different things. I'd love for you to go into to what goes into that selection process about having somebody, as you said, spy for the United States, number one. But then number two, what happens when they go, no, thanks, which I imagine has to happen, right?
Yeah. I mean, again, that's dealing with failure. But here's the thing. So as what we deal with, I mean, I always talked about my life as an operations officer is, it wasn't a psych 101 class. It's a psych 501 class because ultimately I have to determine, someone's motivations to spy. And so, during the Cold War, it was, communism versus capitalism. So maybe a Soviet, diplomatic official like hated his system or her system. And so that's why they would come and work for the United States. Now it's a little bit different. So a lot of times motivation is money. We pay our agents or perhaps we can help a target get their kids to school in the United States. Maybe they need medical care. Maybe they've hit the glass ceiling in their profession and they're discriminated against for some reason. But you're looking at a motivation And I always kind of say that it's not like I have these like, you know, wily skills where I'm going to convince you to do something. You're looking for people who have something, you know, predisposed in them. There's a motivation that we can kind of tap into. And so that to me was the most interesting part and the most challenging part, because you have to find those people. But then make no mistake, when we do recruit someone, and I talk about this in the book, and there's an amazing vignette in there of me sitting with an Arab diplomat who we had recruited. And he was telling me, you know, as we were kind of going over how we were going to meet in his country, using what we call tradecraft, you know, different methods to keep him and I secure. But he said to me, he goes, Mark, if you make one mistake, you know, not only myself, but my whole family's going to die. And it was shocking to me, but really important, because it told me that I had to be, you know, up on my game. But ultimately, you know, that's the essence, that I, as a case officer and operations officer, had these people's lives in my hands. And boy, if you think that's not going to sober you up and get you ready to go to work every day, you know, you're in the wrong line of business.
Yeah. The stakes that most of us can't really even fathom. So, Mark, I'd be remiss if I didn't take advantage of your appearance here with what's going on in the world at this point. I will just fully tell you, for my listeners who have listened to the show and just sort of me in general, I'm not interested in dunking on Democrats or Republicans or what this regime did or in general. But I think you're so uniquely positioned with your experience, having served where you did. What are we at large getting wrong about Afghanistan at the moment, in your opinion?
So, you know, I think there's two things. One is, you know, I would have advocated to have a small force, you know, kind of remain of special operations and intelligence personnel, you know, to deal with the terrorist issue, the counterterrorism operations. But look, the president decided not to do that, and he's commander in chief, and people voted for him, and that's fine. But I think where things went astray a little bit is the execution of the withdrawal. And so, you know, where it matters personally to me is I ran one of our bases in eastern Afghanistan. So between 2011 and 2012, for an entire year, I lived, you know, on the border with Pakistan in the most remote, you know, area imaginable. But ultimately, it was only a couple Americans, and I had hundreds of our Afghan allies as our indigenous fighters. And so why the withdrawal means something to me is, you know, I want to make sure that these people get out and get out and you know, get to safety, because I wouldn't be here today without them. And I have a ton of stories of whether it's on patrol, whether in firefights, an agent meeting in which, you know, we were being betrayed. The Afghan allies that we had, whether it's an interpreter or an Afghan commando, you know, saved my life and the lives of my friends and colleagues. And so there is a moral imperative that we get them out. And I think that's where a lot of us feel that you know, the withdrawal was not handled correctly, because everyone didn't get out. And so I think that's, you know, there's a lot of raw emotion. I mean, I'm certainly have been, you know, all over the media talking about it, whether on, you know, and again, I've been on CNN, yeah, MSNBC, and Fox. So I try not to be partisan on this. I'm just making the point that we have a moral obligation to these people. We got to get them out. And a lot of us feel really strongly about it.
Yeah. And that's where I first saw you and, you know, followed you on Twitter and have basically just sort of seen that point. I think, you know, we're very busy here dunking on our opponent in the U.S., right, which seems so trivial in comparison to what you just said. You mentioned previously the stakes, though, Mark. They're so high. That calling isn't for everybody. What drew you to that life, to being able to, you know, again, balance those kinds of huge, critical, massive decisions? I mean, for a lot of folks, it's like, should we launch the new product? I don't know, maybe. And it's still, you know, it's livelihoods, but it's nowhere near the level that you're talking about. What drew you to this life initially?
Well, I think, you know, I was joking with my parents. You know, my mom passed away, but my dad, you know, who's still alive, he lives in New Jersey, and I always joke this is his fault. And, you know, he never really was thrilled with the idea of me joining the CIA. I was in Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, after 9/11, I spent almost 3 years away from home. Mm-hmm. And so he was, you know, constantly worried about me. But ultimately, you know, when I was young, first of all, I'm part Greek. And so we spent, you know, a lot of time in Greece in the summer. So I traveled a lot. So I had this kind of view of the world. I wanted to do something different. But when I was 10 years old, it's amazing, you know, he took a sabbatical. He was a college professor. So he taught at a university in Algeria. And when I was 10, my mom actually put me on an airplane at JFK Airport by myself. You know, think about that if, you know, anyone who has kids. Like, wow. I wouldn't do that with my kids. But 10 years old, and I flew by myself. And my dad met me, of course, in Algiers, and we traveled 2,000 miles in a Volkswagen minibus through the Sahara Desert, just sleeping in desert oases. And I, of course, you know, thought I was Lawrence of Arabia, but right then I fell in love with the Middle East. And that really, and I mean this seriously, was kind of a catalyst to saying, like, I want to do something different. You know, God bless all my friends who became doctors and lawyers and accountants, and they're on Wall Street and they make a hell of a lot more money than I ever did. But ultimately, I wanted to do something in the national security field. And, you know, I probably read a whole bunch of Tom Clancy novels and And often, you know, I went to Cornell University and I got recruited right out of there. Now at literally the career fair by the CIA, and I joined in 1993. It's really the only job I ever had, which is pretty terrifying. This is why I wrote a book. I was like, what the hell am I going to do when I when I retire, except go, you know, go to Nats games and get mad at them now. So,
well, it really is. It's amazing. You're downplaying. I read those same Tom Clancy novels, and, you know, right. that's not where I went. So, again, it really is impressive. I'd love for you to go into kind of the day to day, if you would, when you're stationed in a forward area, kind of as you've been around the world. The, you know, you wake up and I got to have the sense that there are just waves crashing on the shore and you got to figure out which one's going to reach the furthest and maybe do damage. I know that's a poorly drawn analogy, but what's that like? Like you got to get up in the morning knowing that there's going to be something, but you don't know what. I'd love for you to walk me through that.
Well, so I guess I think it's all situational, you know, dependent. So, you know, if you're in a war zone, or, you know, if I was in Afghanistan or Iraq, sure. You know, you're going to have a hell of a day. But other times, you know, you're posted overseas in a foreign capital, perhaps somewhere. And sometimes, you know, the life of intelligence officer can be boring as well. You know, someone once asked me, like, you know, what's the greatest skill you have? Do you shoot really well? I'm like, not really. Because, you know, when I've been co-located with, you know, U.S. Special Operations Forces, like, and, you know, we've been armed, they would look at me and say, if you have to fire that weapon, like, everyone's dead. Like, you don't want to be the one. And so they say, what's the greatest skill? I'm like, I don't know, typing. And I mean this seriously because, you know, we tell stories. And so if I'm going to go, you know, meet a prospective agent, someone we want to recruit, I have to put it in a cable. So I have to be able to write. A lot of times it's just overturning rocks. I mean, you know, so you got to go out and meet a ton of people. You go to a diplomatic reception and, you know, there's 200 people there. You're trying to find that one person who's interesting, who might be, again, susceptible, have those motivations. And so, you know, there are some times where life as an intelligence officer, it's terrifying. I mean, I was in a U.S. government facility overseas in the Middle East one time. Al-Qaeda attacked the building. You know, there's grenades hitting our roof. I thought we were going to die. A car bomb hit the back. Didn't go off. You know, I'm looking at my buddy. I was our deputy station chief. He was the station chief. And we'd been together in Iraq. And this was in another area, which is it seemed to be a benign place. And kind of looked at each other and we said, man, this might be it. Those are terrifying moments. But then there's other moments where it's, you know, it's a job. And, you know, and you just got to. You know, you're looking for those people who might be interested in working for the USG.
This is going to be another poorly drawn analogy, Mark. Forgive my feeble little sports brain. But sometimes, like, let's say, you know, free agency happens in a sport, right? And an agent feeds something to a reporter. And that reporter is going to report what the agent said. It's not a lie, but there's an agenda behind it, right? And so when you go, there's lots of interest in player X, right? In Mark, he's a great player. He's going to get $20 million a year. Whether that's true or not, that benefits the player. A team could say, we're not interested in or there's not much interest in this guy, hoping that he falls in the draft, whatever it is. But there's an agenda behind it. How do you discern what's true, what's weighted, what's valuable when information comes your way, knowing that there might be an agenda behind it, that somebody is, well, I don't want to say working you, but you follow where I'm going there.
Absolutely. And so it's you know, that's what we call vetting. And so, I think that, you know, maybe my next job, I should be, you know, a member of the Nats front office staff and kind of assessing, you know, their draft picks.
Love
because
it.
That's what we do. You know, you're assessing someone's ability, you know, are they telling the truth? You know, and so you're vetting them. And so if I'm getting a report from an agent, for example, so, you know, this is a raw report. So we have to take a look at that. And so where does this fit in the context? You know, maybe there's other sources we have on the same subject and maybe they're telling us something different. You want to be able to look someone in the eye. You know, you can't always tell if someone's lying or not, but there's nothing like having that face-to-face interaction. And so I think it's a process of keeping an open mind. But again, it's every kind of personal interaction you have. It's just part of the bigger picture. You know, we're gonna check it with other sources of information. Does it make sense? You know, maybe, you know, sometimes we, you know, we have techniques we'll use, you know, in terms of, you know, everyone knows about the polygraph. And I think that, you know, in professional sports, you know, they might be doing that as well. I'm not sure if they're going that far with potential draft picks. But you know what? If you're, you know, just like the United States, if we're going to recruit somebody, you're putting, you know, it's a pretty sacred relationship. We're putting a lot of time and money involved in this. Same thing for a pro team. You're going to draft someone, you might pay them a hell of a lot of money. You want to be really sure, you know, about kind of, in essence, the background checks. Are these people truthful? Like, what are they like? And so, you know, the other thing we'll do is, you know, so if we're trying to recruit a certain individual, we'll have done probably a targeting study on that person. So maybe we're taking a look at everything, like their social medias. I mean, it's so similar. It's kind of scary. to the world of sports, but we're looking at their social media profile. Maybe we know and can talk to their friends and acquaintances, because ultimately you try to get the best possible picture to kind of sign someone up, in essence, who's going to be kind of, you know, have integrity and have some loyalty and engage in this relationship, which is to us really sacred, but very similar, I think, to, you know, a pro sports team is drafting someone and putting a lot of time and money in that.
I got to ask you about your book, Mark, Clarity in Crisis, Leadership Lessons from the CIA. Again, your career is taking you all over the world, and I can't imagine the depth of lessons learned there. Just again, what led you to write it, and you know, just thematically, I imagine adversity is inevitable. What the hell you do with it, kind of is what's going to separate there. But I'd just love you to speak to it.
Sure. So look, you know, as you said before, I spent 26 years at CIA, and I learned from adversity and a ton of failure. And that was kind of the essence of the book. But I wanted to write a book based on kind of leadership principles that I learned, because I was able to lead and operate successfully in what we call kind of the gray area. You know, it's that area where, you know, there's a lack of situational awareness. There's a lot of ambiguity. That was my comfort zone, but that's ultimately being able to embrace these, you know, less than ideal conditions, with no fear. And so, you know, it's the idea of saying, send me, like, I want to be there. And so, you know, even in the book, and so this was applicable to me in, you know, a lot of war zone operations where it was a really chaotic situation, but especially at the end of my career, I was like, well, I'm really good at this. Now, I wasn't a great leader when I started, but I got to be really good. So I came up with these 9 principles on leadership, and there's building blocks, there's kind of foundations on how to get to that position where you're actually really comfortable. So and by the way, I have stories of kind of, you know, CIA operations, which I'm a really good storyteller, so it's a lot of fun for people to read, but it's also, each one is interspersed with stories about baseball. I've been lucky to you know, live in an area where, you know, our local high school team here at James Madison High School, they just won the state championship, but my son played didn't play on the state championship team, but before that, but he learned from some incredible coaches along the way. He played travel baseball down at Richmond for the Richmond Braves, you know, another great travel organization. So I have these kind of baseball stories as well. And, you know, you look at the 2019 Nats. I take a look in the book at the 2003 and 2004 Boston Red Sox. You know, 2003, that, you know, Aaron Boone hits a walk-off in the ALCS. The next year, you know, and the Red Sox lose. The next year, they're down 3-0 against the Yankees again in the ALCS. Kevin Millar gets up and says, "Hey, everyone, we're going to shock the world." You know, they win 4 straight, win that series, win the World Series. But my contention is, you know, that adversity of 2003 is what actually caused them to be able to come back in 2004. So I have tons of stories of CIA operations, tons of baseball stories. But again, it's the idea of just finding yourself in these situations and knowing how to lead when times are really tough. And anybody can be a good leader, you know, if you're up 6-0 in the ninth inning, the manager has got a pretty easy job. But I felt that after my really interesting career, I had something to offer. And you know, I like talking about the CIA to kind of the American people, to everyone, because I think it's an organization, institution that's indispensable, but often, you know, also often misunderstood.
That's a wonderful answer. And Mark, I'm buddies with the former National Counterterrorism Center director, a guy named Mike Leiter, just happens to be a pal of mine. One of the things that we talked about, and I'd love to get your take on this, is sometimes for you folks in the position that you guys are in, a job well done will never get recognized in the public, because something's thwarted. Something that, you know, it's kind of like, I don't know if you saw Christopher Nolan's Tenet, but the bomb that never goes off that we never know about, yep, is the all time kind of win. I'd love, is that ever, I don't say frustrating, I know it's kind of part and parcel with the gig, but I'd love for you to sort of speak to that, where sometimes our biggest wins will just be lost in sort of that day's news.
I mean, that's what you sign up. You join the CIA, you know, you don't sign up for getting a public pat in the back. I mean, so you know, you take a lot of satisfaction that things that you know, that you've affected world events, you know, maybe you've stopped terrorist attacks, you know, but people aren't going to know about it. That's okay. It really is. And if you can't handle that, it's not the right organization, because it's a secret organization ultimately. Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. I go downstairs, you know, in my little, you know, my basement, where I have a, you know, a little weight room set up. But then the hero wall with all these intelligence medals and all these, you know, front pages stories from the Washington Post and the New York Times, primarily of counterterrorism operations no one knows about that were successful and that really saved American lives. And I'll go down there and kind of take a look at that every once in a while, and, you know, smile and have a beer, you know, and kind of reflect on some of the things that I and my colleagues, who I really consider heroes, you know, what we did to save American lives. And there's no doubt that, there's, you know, some incredible moments in my career where I know that, you know, the Americans, you know, were saved. And, you know, there's a kind of a paperweight I had made one time. It's this clear paperweight that I have down there. And it, you know, it's a quote. It says, you know, Americans sleep safely at night because rough men do, you know, are ready to do violence on their behalf. It's a very dramatic quote. I think it's from George Orwell, in fact, but ultimately it's something that I think a lot of us, you know, felt a lot of pride in, that, you know, we don't need people to know, but we did a lot of things to help save, you know, save our fellow Americans. It took a lot of pride in that. And, you know, it's just part of the job. And, you know, you're never going to get, credit, but you know what you did. And you know, I always tell, I would tell my officers after we were in Afghanistan for a year coming back, it's actually appropriate now, is, you know, you're always going to walk a little taller after doing something like that. You know, no one can take that away from you. And so it's really important, you know, again, as you know, to kind of for your own foundation that, hey, we did some really amazing things to help, you know, protect the United States. It's okay. Nobody knows, but we know, you know, maybe our families know, and you kind of just have to kind of take that inner strength and be able to deal with that.
Contrast that with me, like putting the dishes away and like just sort of presenting the kitchen to my wife when she gets home. You know what I mean? Like, where is my credit? Mark, I asked this of everybody. I imagine your answer might be, with all due respect to my previous guest, slightly more fascinating than maybe some others. But give me an all-time career high. Give me a great moment, touchdown dance, end zone spike, maybe a taunting penalty, and then give me an oh my God, what have I done moment.
Yeah. So, you know, and of course, this, you know, this is, as I'm here, I'm obviously talking about the book. It's in the book as well. There's kind of two really, amazing stories. One was when we were in Afghanistan and, you know, we were hunting for a Taliban high value target who had actually was responsible for the death of two CIA officers several years earlier. And kind of over a long period of time, we recruited, individuals on the ground to put this individual on the X to find out, his location. And with a lot of hard work and a lot of fits and starts, we were, I will just say he was removed from the battlefield. And that was satisfying. And he also was plotting attacks against Americans in the future. So we avenged the deaths of two of our officers, and we also saved the lives of U.S. military, U.S. soldiers for the future. But that night, sitting around the fire pit, 7,000 miles away along the border, we were in the most remote place on Earth. It was actually a base which Time magazine earlier had called the most dangerous location on the planet, because we were just, getting firefights and getting rocketed every day by Al-Qaeda and the Taliban from across the border of Pakistan. But what we did is we took out a satellite phone, and, certainly this is not part of the agency playbook, and I didn't ask for permission, but we called one of our officers' widows back in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and told her that we avenged the death of her husband. And we sat around that night and just, that was one of those really amazing moments. Wow. that I think we're all really, really, really proud of. And these stories, the CIA was actually pretty good. They cleared a lot of this. My book goes through a publication review process. And so they cleared that story that I could tell kind of to the American people. And boy, there's been a lot of terrible, failures as well. I mean, one of the worst experiences in my life was, which still haunts me to this day, was losing an officer under my command. And so, someone who I was responsible for was killed in action. I will never forget, the dealings with his family, which were heart-wrenching. I have incredible guilt over it because he was my responsibility. I'll never forget getting in front, up in front of 400 people and kind of announcing the death and seeing people kind of break down. And I talk a lot about that in the book as well. There's the one thing that I kind of go over in the book over and over again is the concept of humility. This is the same as in athletics, is you can't believe your own hype because you will have some incredible highs and some incredible lows. I think, being humble is a really important principle because, I think, great leaders own mistakes and learn, and poor ones scapegoat and deflect. And so you really shouldn't believe your own hype. And so, I had some incredible moments in my career, some awful ones too. And it's just something that I got to live with.
Mark, this was outstanding, my friend. I could talk to you for hours about this, but I've already kept you long enough, man. Thank you so much, man. You're interesting as hell. Congrats on all your success.
Thank you so much.
Thank you again to my guest, Mark Polymeropoulos. Bit of housekeeping here, and I'll post all this stuff in the description, but give him a follow at mpolymer on Twitter. ClarityInCrisisBook.com for his book, Clarity in Crisis, Leadership Lessons from the CIA. You heard him address and kind of go through a little bit of that. And his personal website is FindingClarityInTheShadows.com. And he's available for speaking gigs as well through the Harry Walker Agency. Again, I'll post all this stuff down in the description. So many great things to pull out of there. The first, and I've heard this
from a couple folks I know. I've got a buddy that's has worked for the State Department and has, you know, he and his family have lived in a couple locales around the world. And that's an excitement he expressed. It kind of gives you this renewed appreciation for the United States and the opportunities that it affords. Plenty to complain about, I'm sure. That's with everybody. That's natural. But, you know, kind of the time away, the absence kind of makes the heart grow fonder there. So I definitely heard that before. And that was neat to hear from Mark. The part, again, and you guys have checked out the show at all, you know the things I'm sort of fascinated by, right? Some like kind of how the machine works and how the sausage gets made. Imagine, put yourself in Mark's shoes as best you can, or even an analyst or anybody in Mark's employ in one of these areas. You're basically going, I think we might have somebody that ultimately, at the end of the day, is going to serve the U.S.'s interests and not the interests of their own country or organization or whatever it is. And you're trying to identify that kind of person. It could be, as Mark alluded to it, things I hadn't even thought of. It could be financial. It could be, you know, family health, or it could be a, you know, a better life for the kids of this person. Maybe, hey, you'll get into a U.S. school. Or I think of in the Hunt for Red October, you know, it's like, I would like to live on a lake, raise horses in Montana, whatever the hell it was, right? Then Mark Aurelius wanted. You think of those sorts of things. You've got to identify that desire and sort of coax them into doing something that they've kind of been indoctrinated not to do. Again, to serve the interests of what would be, in theory, their enemy. That's a pretty amazing leap to make, right? It starts off kind of small, and then the next thing you know, they're feed intelligence. Then while all that's going on, you've got to make sure that what they're giving you is right. So you heard Mark talk about the vetting process as well. I would always wonder about that. I mean, listen, his training for over decades makes him eminently more qualified than I would be to do this, but I would be consumed with doubt in the sense that this is what this guy told us. How much of this is fake? How much of this is him doing just enough to pretend to be useful, to kind of string us along, to earn some more money? You don't know. You just don't know. And that goes to the real big theme of what Mark was talking about. And, you know, sort of we share a common love for baseball, the failure. The failure rate at this is super high. And it also goes back to what I talked about kind of at the top of the show. We know about the colossal, famous, have become public, maybe shortfalls, controversies, whatever you want to call it, of the intelligence community. And we know about those. And it's very easy to cherry pick and say, well, this wasn't the right thing to do because of XYZ. And there are thousands of failures, but we don't know about all of those successes. We don't know about how many operations were thwarted, how many people were brought to justice, how many would-be terrorists were steered into a different path or eliminated altogether, or, you know, a government that wanted to do us wrong or American citizens wrong. We just don't know. And that's kind of the hallmark. And that's sort of the life, right? Where your mistakes are picked on, your victories are never celebrated outside of kind of a select few. And it's just such a fascinating dynamic to be in that world of intelligence. I'm somebody that, you know, even as a grown-up, I'm 42 now. When I do a good job or something good happens, I'd like someone to say congratulations. Or like someone to say, hey man, good job. That was good. You know, we appreciate what you did. Even if it's something as small, even I joked with Mark, it's like, you know, like yesterday I emptied the dishwasher and I kind of kept waiting for my wife to be like, thanks so much for doing that. It's such a stupid, dumb, trivial thing. I shouldn't need a thank you, but yet here I am being like, hey, could you mention that I did it? And I put all the silverware in the right spot. I actually didn't know where this one cooking dish went because I don't know where any of the cooking dishes go, even though we've lived together for 15 years now. But that's a quick digression. But again, just going back to Mark's points from that he kind of addressed with me and then from his book as well, you just sort of think about there's an understanding here that adversity, to the level of which, again, is difficult for most of us to comprehend in our daily lives, is absolutely 100% inevitable. What you do with it is going to determine, you know, some more and more outcomes. And this is such a process-oriented thing that you're going to experience high stakes. You're going to experience some of these challenges. And if he can do it with his, you know, his feet, his sides, his head, and his arms and legs to the fire, you're going to be able to do it too, kind of in your regular life. I think that was sort of the thematic takeaway for me, just hearing about his book. And I got a copy of it. Can't wait to crack it and get reading. And to be frank with you, now that both my kids are in school, I might have some time to read books again, which I'm looking forward to. I kind of sacrificed that over the last 6-7 years as those kids are just around, man, all the time. They're like, oh, I'm hungry, blah, blah, blah. Whatever. I'll get you some food. But again, thank you to Mark for the great chat. Really, really good conversation. I could talk to that guy for hours. And I've seen him a bunch. He's been all over the news. And I've sort of, you know, once I saw him on one of the news stations making his, again, I think above partisan comments related to his experience about what's going on in Afghanistan, I said, well, this is non-nonsense here. Right. This isn't just somebody they're brought on to agree with the host. This isn't someone that just was there to say, yeah, Democrats are bad, or yeah, Republicans are stupid. This was above that. And that's what drew me to him. So followed him and just kind of checked out some of his stuff and came away just really impressed. And I bet you guys probably were too with Mark Polymeropoulos. So thanks to him for joining the show. Thank you guys for listening as well. Thanks to my producer, Andrew Russell. Always appreciate it. We got some cool guests coming up for you guys here in the not-too-distant future. Remember, check us out for free a couple weeks after the launch. That's Amazon Music, Google Pods, Apple Play, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. That's cool, bro. At UCM Interesting on the Instagrams, interest_pod on the Twitterverse. And if you want to be a paying customer and help out the team, patreon.com/funnydanny is the place to do that. Until next week, all of you, UCM Interesting.